From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Is she a pathological liar or a woman just trying to tell a good story? Margaret B. Jones wrote a memoir that seemed headed for the bestseller list. In Love and Consequences, she described growing up as a half-white, half-Native American girl raised by a black foster family in South L.A. She wrote about things like running drugs for the Bloods and watching a friend die in a gang shootout. Here's the author reading from her book on one of our sister shows at NPR, Tell Me More.
Gangs in L.A. recruit like the NFL. They go out, they look at kids. Okay, that kid doesn't have parents. That kid's kind of messing up at school. Ooh, look at that kid. That kid can fight.
The problem is that the whole story was a lie. The author was never recruited by a gang. Her name isn't even Margaret B. Jones. It's Margaret Seltzer. She's white. She grew up in an affluent part of Los Angeles with her biological family. How did this literary fraud about gang life slip through the cracks? Joining us now is Motoko Rich, the New York Times reporter who broke the story in Tuesday's paper. Hi, Motoko.
Hi, Farai.
So you broke the story. Can you summarize what the book is about? Just tell us a little bit more about Seltzer.
Well, about Seltzer herself, she is actually a 33-year-old woman who grew up in Sherman Oaks, California, graduated from a private high school, was never raised by a foster family, never ran drugs for the Bloods, as she claims in this sort of completely fabulous memoir where she characterizes herself, as you said, as part white, part Native American, raised by this black family in South Central L.A., running drugs. And I mean, it's a very elaborate, vividly told memoir with lots of anecdotes in it that a lot of people fell for.
The New York Times itself published a really rave look at this book, and no one seems to be questioning that it's well written. Do you think that's one reason why she was able to get away with it?
Well, that's a good question. I think there are a lot of – it's complicated why she was able to get away with it. There were not enough questions asked along the way. I think that's part of the problem, that she was sort of taken on her word. She was discovered, if you will. She was a student at University of Oregon in Eugene, and she had an ethnic studies professor who liked some of her writing and referred her to another writer who was working on a book about racism. And this writer interviewed Margaret Seltzer about her experiences, which she presented in this sort of fabulous way about, you know, she had already begun characterizing herself as this persona. And that writer interviewed her and included some anecdotes from her alleged life in her book. And then that writer referred Ms. Seltzer to her agent, who read some pages, loved them, and got her a book deal. And at that point in the chain, she had been referred by a couple of people that were trusted by both the agent and the publisher, and they never really thought to question her story.
Now, Seltzer was getting a lot of critical acclaim for the book. She was doing interviews, planning a book tour. Let's go back and hear a little bit more of the Tell Me More interview where she tells host Michelle Martin a little bit about her writing process. Now, remember, she said this before her book was exposed as a fraud.
Everything's true. It's just, let's say, like the scene where I went to the grocery store with my little sisters, there was more like, instead of three of us, there was five of us. But I sort of combined them into one person.
Motoko, you went on to write another story following up with the publishers. And can you explain what kind of evidence, I guess that's the word, she provided to them?
Well, what they told me was that she provided a letter from someone who she said was an OG, for original gang leader, who seemed to corroborate her story, who said, I grew up in the West Adams neighborhood of L.A., and so did Margaret Jones. He used that name. She also, in taping a video that was supposed to be used by the publisher to promote her book, took her an agent on a tour of the neighborhood she allegedly grew up in and introduced her to a woman who claimed to be her foster sister. So among those things and the fact that she had been interviewed by another writer and her experiences had been written by another person gave them the comfort level that this was all true. But most of it, I think, came from her just saying, this is true, this is my life, and them believing her.
You know, obviously this isn't the first time that people have made up memoirs. You've got James Fry with A Million Little Pieces, and ultimately Oprah kind of put him in a headlock on that one. Mm-hmm. Recently you had a Holocaust memoir called Misha that was proven to be a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
Is this going to transform in any way the publishing? Is there a conversation, I guess, in the publishing industry about how to change the practices so this might not happen?
Well, you'd think there would probably be more of a conversation, and those examples that you mentioned aren't even the first of them. I mean, you can go back to the 70s when Clifford Irving got a huge advance to write kind of an authorized autobiography of Howard Hughes, and that was a complete hoax. He never talked to Howard Hughes, and luckily that was caught just before they went to publication. A few years ago, a Swiss memoir, also a Holocaust memoir, was completely debunked. The person who said he wrote it was not who he said he was. He was not. He had not spent time in Polish concentration camps, but had lived in relative affluence in Switzerland during the war. And yet, there doesn't seem to be as much sort of soul searching that you would expect. When I interviewed some publishers on Tuesday in the aftermath of the revelations about Love and Consequences, people emphasized that this is an industry that's based on trust, that they have to ask their authors to tell the truth and rely upon them to do so, and that, in fact, Margaret Seltzer signed a contract in which part of one clause gave her a legal obligation to tell the truth. But these same questions were asked after James Frey. He didn't make up a whole persona. I mean, he was a drug addict who served time and went to a recovery center, but he did embellish and make up quite a few details, including the alleged fact in his book that he had spent something like 3 months in jail when he only spent a few hours. But even after that scandal, there didn't seem to be as much change in sort of the processes of fact-checking or looking into, you know, asking just a few key questions even right. of their authors.
Well, Motoko, thanks for filling us in on the story.
Thank you.
Motoko Rich is a staff reporter for the New York Times Culture Desk. She joined us from NPR Studios in New York. And now we're going to talk about why. That is, why would someone appropriate a narrative of urban struggle? Issa Yulin blogs about writing, among other things, at issayulin.com. And she teaches English at Hunter College in New York City and wrote the novel Crystal Morning. Hey, Issa.
Hi, good morning, Fry.
So you read the book review for Love and Consequences in the Times. What was your reaction?
Well, when I first read the review, I was a little bit taken aback by the idea that a white-looking girl would be adopted or taken in by a black foster family, particularly in South Central, particularly in a gang-ridden neighborhood of South Central. I just thought that that was a bit odd. I live in Brooklyn, and I've traveled through much of black America. And as an African American, I can say that, you know, it's very rare that, at least anecdotally, I've ever seen or even heard of black families taking in white children. The transracial thing usually goes the other way.
So, you know, in Motoko's article, Seltzer says that she wanted to, quote, put a voice to people who people don't listen to. So do you believe that this was some form of public service? Do you think that she was ego tripping? Do you think she just wanted the money? If you had to put, you know, on your psychic cap, why do you think this kind of thing happens?
You know, I thought for a while, particularly, you know, with the whole Native American thing and that she seemed to be sort of expressing this persona for so many years, even prior to obtaining the book contract, I thought maybe there was, I don't know, I mean, I'm no Dr. Phil, but maybe there's actually something psychologically wrong with her that compels her to take on this persona for some reason. I don't know, something that happened in her childhood. It just seems really odd. And in terms of giving a voice to the voiceless, I think, unfortunately, this author has silenced the authentic black experience more than revealing any truths about what it means to be dispossessed in America. So if she had some kind of liberal intention to express the truth of black life, she actually had the reverse effect.
What narratives, how do basically African-American authors or authors of color enter the publishing world? Do people enter, if you have a memoir and you are black, do you enter the world with a perspective from some publishers like, well, we've heard this before. We know black people are screwed up. So, you know, we don't want another one of these. I mean, was part of this just a man bites dog situation?
I do. I think it's sort of like the, you know, 7 years in Tibet Tarzan phenomenon where you have this lone white person or white looking person, because she did claim that she was part Native American, among, you know, black folks. And it's the story of survival and overcoming and getting through. And you know, it's like she's Sheena of the jungle and can talk to the natives in a way that, you know, the rest of Middle America can't. And that in of itself, of course, is at the very least problematic. It's also interesting because she talks about giving a voice to the voiceless, but we do have, you know, gang memoirs. There's East Side Stories, Gang Life in East L.A., there's Monster, there's Inside the Crips, there's My Bloody Life, The Making of a Latin King. Snoop Pearson from The Wire has a book out, or coming out, if I'm not mistaken. And
yep,
then there are classics like
it.
Down These Mean Streets and Makes Me Wanna Holler. So we have, not to mention photography, film, music. I mean, she really wasn't doing us any favors.
Just quickly, do you think, are you hopeful that the publishing industry will learn something from this?
I hope so. You know, Terry Williams has mentored an actual former gang member who has a book deal. And what's wonderful about Terry Williams is that she didn't secure a book deal for herself. She enabled somebody who really had these experiences to be able to tell his own story. And if this woman, Seltzer, actually had the intention of giving a voice to the voiceless, I certainly wish that she had helped use her contacts to enable somebody who really had these experiences to tell their real story. You know, somebody didn't get a book published that year because her book was pushed up and put on the cycle. Somebody got a lower advance or didn't get an advance at all because she got almost $100,000 for this. So I think the industry is really going to have to take a hard look at itself and really do some self-analysis, especially when it comes to race and the white experience with the darker other.
All right, Issa, thank you so much.
Thank you, Farai.
Issa Yulin is the author of the novel Crystal Morning. She also teaches English at Hunter College in New York City. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Is our democracy really based on one man, one vote? And can you really be sure the ballot you drop in the box will actually count? Critics of America's democracy say our election process is just plain unfair. Their proof? Well, who could forget Florida 2000? That experience left the phrase hanging chad on people's lips for months. And this week, there were even allegations of voter irregularities in the Democratic primary races in Texas and Ohio. Some folks argue the problem with our election system is written right into the rules, but other observers have more faith in our modern voting process. So if it ain't really broke, why fiddle with it? Joining me now to hash things out is William Poundstone. He's the author of Gaming the Vote, Why Elections Aren't Fair and What We Can Do About It. Also, Robert Trainum. He's the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network, CN8. Bill and Robert, thanks for coming on.
Yes, hi, good to be with you.
So let's start with the basics. Most people think of the American system as one man, one vote. Bill, can you break down for me simply how our electoral process is and is not one person, one vote?
Yeah, well, each person basically indicates what candidate they like best of all on the ballot. And in many situations, that's all you need. But there are situations where you've got more than two strong candidates out there, and then you get into all these vote splitting and spoilers, and you can often have a situation where the most popular candidate doesn't win. So a lot of people, like theorists who have looked into this, say that there really are fairer ways to vote, and we should be looking into that.
Before we get to that, though, when you know, because you have a list of different systems and how they work, how do you fundamentally define fairness? What does fairness mean to you?
It's really that everyone's vote should count exactly the way they want it to count. For instance, to bring up 2000 again, there were a lot of Ralph Nader voters who basically wanted an extremely liberal president. But what they got in Florida, they tipped the vote from Gore to Bush, and they got a conservative president. So that really doesn't make much sense.
Before I move on to Robert, give me one example of a system that might have prevented something like that.
Well, the one, it's actually very interesting. Both Barack Obama and John McCain have been promoting a system known as instant runoff voting. And this is a system where you rank the candidates, like 1, 2, 3. And if you vote for one of these third-party candidates who has no chance of winning, your ballot would actually count for the major party candidate you've ranked higher. So if you liked Nader but you ranked Obama second, your vote would count towards Obama.
Robert, what do you think about this? I mean, instant runoff voting has been used in some municipalities. It's kind of in the experimental stage in a lot of places. Do you think that we should make a big change in how U.S. democracy operates?
No, and here's why. It works. Now, that isn't to say that there isn't chinks in the armor, because there certainly is. We certainly saw that in Florida in 2000. We saw it in Ohio in 2004. And we're currently seeing it now throughout this presidential primary cycle. But let's keep in mind that this is a system that is evolutionary, Farai. If you take a look at the history of this country, whether it be through the women's suffrage movement, through the poll tax, the grandfather clause, obviously all throughout the civil rights movement in the 1960s and early 70s, the process has always been improved through change. And that change has always been when the people themselves, or ourselves, Americans as ourselves, have come up with a better way of voting. Now, that isn't to say that our voting system is near perfect. Gosh darn it, we have 280 million people in this country, and unfortunately, we're going to get it wrong sometimes. But what does work is that every single state in this country participates in the process, whether it be through the primary process or through the general election process. And we have, candidly speaking, come out on head when it comes to making sure that every single vote is counted. We're doing that now through touch tone screening. We're doing that now with advanced 21st technologies out there when it comes to voting. Now, again, let me just be very clear. There's still room for improvement, but I firmly do believe that the current system is working.
Now, again, before I go back to Bill, there's not always one system. We see like the caucuses, the primaries, paper ballots, electronic ballots, you know.
Absentee ballots.
Yeah, exactly. People sitting around a room holding hands, talking about who they want. So how are you even supposed to make sense of the fact that we don't really have one standardized system?
Well, I think that's the uniqueness of this country, because every single the way our country has been founded and the way it's governed is from the bottom up. In other words, the states should have the right to be able to come up with a system that's best for them. The founding fathers of this country specifically made a provision, and at least in their minds, I'm not sure if it was ever written down, and maybe it is through the Constitution, where every single state has the right to be able to come up with their own governing system and their own voting system, i.e. through their state constitution. And, you know, that's the fundamental right that we all have as states' rights.
Bill, when you think about our system today and you think about the idea of not changing things, as Robert would argue, mm-hmm. what are the upsides and downsides of that? Because, you know, any big transformation can also cause huge ripple effects as people mm-hmm. adjust to it. What would it take if you favor instant runoff and the system of kind of tiered voting? How difficult would it be, aside from whether or not people would choose to make that change, how difficult would it be to switch people to that?
Well, I don't think it's difficult at all. The state of North Carolina is now phasing in instant runoff voting. Minneapolis, San Francisco, Berkeley, just this week, Santa Fe, New Mexico adopted it. So it is really something that's starting to get a certain amount of political momentum. I think it really does take a certain amount of education on the part of the public. And I would agree. I mean, it is an evolutionary process. When this country was started, we didn't even have a popular vote for president or senator. That was sort of a retrofit that came in later because people thought about it and realized that it would make sense. So I think particularly with Obama and McCain speaking in favor of it, we're really going to start to have a national conversation about whether there are fairer ways to vote than the plurality vote.
Farai?
Please, go ahead.
You know, what's very interesting about all of this is, and I'm glad that Bill agrees with the evolutionary process, because there's a huge educational curve that Americans go through every time we try to change the voting system, and albeit for good intentions. Recall, back in 2000, we heard pregnant chads and dimple chads and so forth, and never before we ever let something like that happen again. In 2004, or between 2000 and 2004, all these states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and these other states, rushed to try to get the touch tone screens up to running for 2004. And guess what happened? There were thousands of people that were in line, particularly in Ohio and Florida, that said, you know what, this is not working for me. I don't understand this. This is way too complicated. So my point is that with change comes time, and with time comes an evolutionary process where we have to educate the American people that this is a good thing, but that's going to take time, at least probably, you know, 10, 15, 20 years before we can actually have, in my opinion, an instant runoff system in this country, national,
that is. Robert, I want to ask about these issues of fairness in voting just actually at the polls? Because you mentioned Ohio. Just this week, Clinton and Obama's camps cried foul at each other for perceived irregularities in voting in Texas and Ohio. And Obama asked for polls across Ohio to remain open an extra hour and a half. A federal judge okayed that request for some polls, mainly in Cleveland. How does this kind of wrangling reflect not necessarily anything about paper ballots versus electronic, but whether or not governments are making a commitment to allowing enough people to enter the process simply by staffing and issues like that?
Well, it certainly diminishes the public confidence in the voting system when they literally stand up in line at 7 o'clock in the morning, and when the doors open, the poll workers do not know how to work the machines. And that also speaks to when the county commissioners out there and the borough managers out there are screaming for more help from the federal government. And that's the main reason why the federal government passed the Help America Vote Act back in 2001 after the 2000 presidential fiasco, so that this would never happen again. Unfortunately, we're seeing it happen again, as you mentioned, in Ohio and Texas. And what's very interesting about this, Farai, is that oftentimes it happens in minority communities, in communities where people may not be as educated as a upper middle class community, or perhaps the community is where multiple ballots are placed on the ballot, and it's meant to confuse the voter out there. And I think that's where we need to really try to educate the American people, but in specifically in underserved communities where there's mass confusion, and that confusion is based on predatory folks out there that cause chaos for some type of political gain.
Bill, when you look ahead at this election, and I mean the general election, are we still going to have problems, in your opinion, with electronic voting, with poll access? There's controversies over the voter ID laws as well. What are you looking ahead at?
Yeah, I think that's something to worry about. Again, you don't want to overreact to one problem in one election, and I think the Help America Vote Act, in many senses, was not a terribly good idea. For instance, Ronald Rivest, who's a very famous mathematician at MIT, he's one of the inventors of the RSA system that's used by PayPal and other electronic transactions. He's also looked into the security of electronic voting. And you'd figure if anyone believed in electronic voting, it would be him. But he's really come to the conclusion that it's too easy to hack. You really have to worry about this. And really, the paper ballots are the best way to go. But I hasten to add that with paper ballots, you can still have many other ways of voting, with instant runoff, something called range voting, various other methods.
Robert, when you look ahead, just briefly, what do you see? Do you see an issue where we're going to face some big challenges?
Yes, especially when you have record turnout. And anytime you have record turnout, the system simply, unfortunately, cannot handle the volume of people that are standing in line and voting. And that's when a lot of irregularities happen. That's when a lot of mass confusion happens. If you take a look at the primaries overall this year, and when you look at where Senator Obama is doing so well, where he's overperforming in some states, ironically, I looked at this last night in preparation for the segment, is that when typically that's when there's a lot of mass confusion. It's because there's just so many people that are standing in line that the poll workers and or the machine simply just can't handle it.
Well, I want to thank both of you gentlemen for coming in. There's not going to be a definitive answer right now, and there's going to be, I'm sure, a lot going on. But thanks for coming in.
Yes, thanks, good to be here.
William Poundstone is the author of Gaming the Vote, Why Elections Aren't Fair and What We Can Do About It. He joined me here at our NPR West studios. And Robert Trainum is the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network, CN8. He was on the line from our NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Today, we start a month-long series on mental health. Some people call being healthy having your mind right. When do you know that it's not, and that you or someone you know needs help? How can you get that help? How does race factor into the whole equation? In a few minutes, we'll speak with two experts in the mental health field, but right now we have author and comedian Brian Copeland. His stage production, Not a Genuine Black Man, became the longest-running one-man show in San Francisco's history. Now he's headed for Broadway and working with HBO on a national TV series. But as his book of the same name will tell you, Brian has faced down his demons and lived to tell the tale, even laugh about it. Brian, thanks for coming back on.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Farai.
So you turned your life into a stage play and a book, and a lot of Not a Genuine Black Man focuses on your childhood. Just give us a sense of what kind of pressure your family was under.
Well, the gist of it is that in 1972, we moved to San Leandro, California, which borders Oakland, at a time when San Leandro was 99.99% white and considered by fair housing advocates to be one of the most racist suburbs in America. And Oakland next door was half black. San Leandro was very inhospitable to black people. It was a town that was built on white flight from the big cities to the suburbs. And so growing up here, we, you know, dealt with all kinds of grief and harassment, and my mother had to fight eviction and these types of things. Then later on, I ended up having to deal with really racism from both sides, from white people as well as from black people who claimed that I was not really black because of the music I listen to or the way that I speak or some intangible delineation that that people make in terms of how you're supposed to behave based upon the color of your skin.
Well, Brian, you know, you went on to basically go about your life and kind of sublimate this incredible pressure, but at some point it all broke for you. What happened then?
Well, what happened was, I should back up and say that at the time that I wrote Not a Genuine Black Man, the book and the play, I decided that in order for it to be real and to be true and to be what I wanted it to be, I'd have to be completely naked. And that being the case, I knew that I would have to talk about the darkest moment in my life, which was a very severe period of depression I went through in 1999. I didn't realize it at the time, but apparently I had suffered depression since childhood, just from all of the, you know, strangers driving down the street yelling the N-word, not being included because I was the only black kid and being different. And I'd spent a lot of time isolating and by myself. And I got to this point in 1999 where it was 20 years after I'd lost my mother, and she was, along with my grandmother, the two guiding lights in my life. And something happens, I've since found out talking to other people, that when you lose a parent at a relatively young age, when you hit the age that when you hit the age that you lost your parent and you realize I'm their age or I'm, you know, going to outlive them now, there's something psychological that happens. Some people go through a midlife crisis. Other people go into depression. I went into deep, deep depression as a result of it and as a result of the upbringing. So it culminated. I didn't realize what it was, but now looking back at it, it was all the classic symptoms. I didn't enjoy anything anymore. The hobbies and things that I liked, I didn't like anymore. I spent more and more time by myself. I was low on energy. I had trouble, you know, even getting out of bed in the morning. And finally, it culminated one night with me going into the garage of my house and letting the top down on my sports car and starting the motor. And had a neighbor not heard the music playing. I had a CD playing in the stereo, and had a neighbor not heard it and thought that was kind of odd and, you know, call the police to come and investigate, I wouldn't be here.
We're going to actually ask you to stay with us over a short break, but just very quickly, what was the first thing you thought when you knew that you were going to live and not die?
I was disoriented, really, and I wasn't sure that I was alive. The first thing I thought was, and I write this in the book, and it's funny, but it's the truth. I was out, and the first thing that I see when I open my eyes is a white police officer. Now, again, I've spent my life being hassled by white cops. And the first thing I thought was, do you mean to tell me, after everything I've been through, that St. Peter is a white cop? That was the first thing that went through my mind.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that is a clear sign of your sense of humor. Brian, just stay with us. We won't keep you too much longer. Brian Copeland is the author of the book and creator of the production, Not a Genuine Black Man. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. This month, we are focusing on the critical issue of mental health. We're also speaking with Brian Copeland, the author of the book and creator of the production, Not a Genuine Black Man. Brian, we were just talking about your suicide attempt, how after a childhood of really dealing with some of the worst of racial tensions in America, abusive racial tensions by your neighbors, and dealing with your mother's death, you reached a point where you tried to commit suicide. And what I would ask you just finally is how did you transform from someone who was at that point in your life to someone who now has had so much success in your work? What was it that allowed you to heal?
Well, I think telling the story has been a real big part of it, and I'll tell you the amazing thing about this entire process is that most people who go through depression are dealing with two things. First of all, there is the fact that you think that you're all alone. You think that nobody else in the world is going through what you're going through. Nobody else in the world deals with it, that there's something wrong with you, and that you don't tell people about it because you feel like you've got a great big scarlet D, you know, that you're wearing on your chest. And what's interesting is that once I started doing the play and once the book came out, I started to hear from people who I knew for years and had no idea that they struggled with it and had been on antidepressants and had been suicidal and had, you know, it just struggled to get through the day. I mean, people who I looked at and thought, you know, had it all together. It was just amazing to me. I got one woman, I'll never forget this, one night I was doing a play, and there was an attorney in the audience. You know, it was a Friday night. She'd come straight from her office, dressed in a business suit, a woman you look at, she's got it all together. And she says to me after the show, she says, I think about killing myself every single day of my life, and I never told anybody about it because I thought they'd lock me up, but now I'm going to go and seek some help. So that's been a really important part of this whole process. And the other thing, too, is that colleges and universities are assigning the book as required reading, and a lot of it is because of the depression aspect, because so many students suffer from it.
Well, Brian, thank you so much. Really appreciate you sharing your story and coming on again. Thanks. Brian Copeland is the author of the book and creator of the production, Not a Genuine Black Man. And on a broader level, we're going to ask the question, is there a mental health crisis in the black community? If so, what can we do about it? With us, we have Dr. William Lawson. He's a professor and the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Howard University College of Medicine. And Dr. Annelle Prim, she's the director of Minority and National Affairs for the American Psychiatric Association. Welcome.
Hi.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Prim, I'm going to start with you. We just heard this story of reaching rock bottom and then coming up. It's pretty easy to understand that you have a problem if you have made a suicide attempt. But first, let's back up a little bit. What are signs that you may not be functioning well on an emotional and mental health level? What should people look for in themselves or even in family members?
People should look for a change in mood. You know, being sad or irritable or very anxious, a change in how they feel about themselves, having low self-esteem, and a change in their sense of well-being, changes in sleep, appetite, energy level, and so forth, many of the things that Brian Copeland spoke about.
I want to ask you this first, Dr. Prim, and also Dr. Lawson. How do African Americans face these challenges in terms of, is there a different way due to race or socioeconomics or culture that black Americans are walking this road of dealing with mental health than perhaps other communities?
Well, culture and race definitely play a role. The fact that African Americans are often looked upon negatively, unfortunately, in our society, owning up to having a mental health need is really a double whammy and really contributes to the stigma surrounding mental illness. I think also from a cultural standpoint, the fact that religion and spirituality are so central in the African American community, people may believe that their mental health issues may represent a failure of faith. They may turn to their clergy person for help and may not realize that they need to get professional help from a health or mental health professional.
Dr. Lawson, what about the both, you know, are people getting the diagnoses they need in the black community, the help that they need, or even willing to go ask for help?
Well, I think that you mentioned the term crisis. I'm not sure that there is a crisis. I remember that when I was growing up in a rural, predominantly African-American community, there were several suicides in my high school. And later on, it was only in medical school that I discovered that black people didn't kill themselves and didn't get depressed. So a lot of the data that we now have showing this incredible increase in suicide rate for African-American men, I think, is more that we're much more willing to get it labeled as such. But despite that, we found that many times many folks simply do not discuss it between their family or others. And because we haven't had the access to services, and because of the stigma, we develop alternative ways of dealing with these kinds of issues by even not talking about it. There's a phenomenon we call John Henryism, where people become compulsive workers to mass feelings of depression, despondency, and wanting to do themselves in. And there's many instances in which folks commit what I call slow suicide. The person who drinks themselves to death, the AIDS patient who ceases taking their medication, the individuals who become involved in all kinds of high risky behavior, such as pulling a toy gun on a policeman in a high crime area. These are all suicide attempts, but they wouldn't be labeled as such traditionally.
I want to go to something that you mentioned, the increasing rate, at least according to statistics, of suicide among Black men. You were essentially saying that a lot of times in the past that seems to have been covered up. So is there an increasing problem in your opinion, or is it part of the human condition that's been with us for a while?
I think it's probably a combination of both. I think just overall there's been an increase in depression and suicide in the U.S., but I think that much of the increase in African-American men is a good deal of recognition of labeled suicide. I've just seen too many instances of going to coroner's office. In one case, we had a young man lying there with a bullet hole in his head and a gun in his hand, and it was and the coroner said, "Aha! Somebody shot this young man and put a gun in his hand," because Black people don't commit suicide. So I think these kinds of belief systems are a real hindrance in trying to understand some of the true epidemiology of this. And again, I think that this rate is much higher than we think, because we have other ways of doing it through some of the ways in which we deal with chronic diseases and health conditions. Some of the disparities, I think, is a result of folks committing slow suicide.
Dr. Prim, not everybody has the same access to health care. Some of us have different health plans. Some people have no health plan. But then there's also the question of whether people are using the resources they have. Some people say, well, I'll just talk to my friends, or I'll just go to church. Are those good alternatives to what we consider medical treatment?
Well, certainly it is important to have family support and the support of friends when you're going through something like depression, but you really do need to see a health professional. We really stress the fact that mental illnesses like depression are treatable, but you need to see a qualified health professional to receive that treatment.
What about cultural issues with treatment? We're going to talk extensively tomorrow as part of the series about therapy, but there's not always, there sometimes can be things that are lost in translation across cultures. Do you think that people who go in either to talk therapy or to get medication or just even to get an evaluation have to be aware that the person who's listening to them may not be hearing what they're saying in the same way?
That's absolutely a concern. We like to think that the mental health professionals who would evaluate and treat someone would be knowledgeable about that person's culture, because culture does play an important role in terms of belief systems and even the way someone might express their illness. For instance, with depression, sometimes a presenting complaint might be anger. And if a clinician doesn't realize that, they may be on their way to making the wrong diagnosis. So they may assume that someone who is suspicious has schizophrenia, but the suspiciousness could be a part of another syndrome, including a mood disorder. And we know that this happens, that sometimes people are misdiagnosed with illnesses like schizophrenia when really what's going on is a mood disorder like depression.
Dr. Lawson, you mentioned all the ways that people could commit slow suicide. And it's not even just people committing suicide, but a lot of behaviors like addiction also have a parallel in people's mental health. So moving out from the individual to the community, how important is it for mental health treatment and mental health wellness to be a part of the life of Black communities?
I think it's extremely important. I mean, the point to recognize is that pretty much most of our many chronic diseases, almost all of them have worse outcomes when they're associated with mental disorders. We know that people who have a heart attack and who also have major depression are much more likely to die. We know that the biggest risk factor for non-compliance in terms of AIDS treatment is depression because of people's failure to take the medication. And I'm glad you mentioned the issue of substance abuse, because there's increasing evidence that in many cases substance abuse often masks underlying mental disorders that can be treated. Oftentimes, trying to treat the substance abuse alone is ineffectual unless we recognize the underlying mental disorder, and also vice versa. Many in the community continue to believe that cocaine or a bottle of scotch are effective antidepressants, and they are not. And in fact, they are also major risk factors for suicide because they increase impulsive behavior.
Dr. Prim, just quickly, where's a good place to turn for help if people are hearing this and want some?
Well, if people would like more information, the American Psychiatric Association has a website, healthyminds.org. We have access on that website to a new fact sheet called Let's Talk Facts about Mental Health in the African American Community. And there's other information there that would be of interest to African Americans wanting to know more about mental illness and what to do about it.
Well, Dr. Prim, Dr. Lawson, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Annelle Prim is the Director of Minority and National Affairs for the American Psychiatric Association. She spoke with us from our studios in Washington, D.C. And Dr. William Lawson is a professor and the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Howard University College of Medicine. Be sure to check out our website. Our regular contributor, Judge Lynn Toler, shares her top 10 steps to achieving emotional acuity. Our website is nprnewsandnotes.org. And Lynn Toler's work is from her book, My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. It's Thursday and time to unzip the mailbag. Joining me now to sort through your letters is producer and editor Christopher Johnson. Hey, Christopher.
Hey, Farai. Well, we knew they were coming, and we got a few letters about our bloggers' roundtable yesterday when things got a little out of control. Now, the four of you were discussing the tight race between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Blogger and former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross got kind of carried away.
The bottom line is Barack Obama has got, you remember that game Rock'em Sock'em Robots and you had the red one and the blue one? He's got to bash her face in. He's got to knock her block off.
But how do you really feel?
He's got to knock her block off. Because in the game of politics, if we were dealing with those robots, that's the objective. You've got to knock the block off.
Our listener Karen Babbitt in California says that even though Rock'em Sock'em Robots is just a toy, she is so not amused by Kevin's comment. Karen writes, I am sorry to report that I heard something during the bloggers' roundtable that made me change my mind about the show. It was Kevin Ross who said Obama needed to bash Clinton's face in. I don't care how upset he was about attack ads the Clinton campaign ran in Texas or Ohio, or even about tactics the campaign has used in other primaries. There's no excuse for advocating violence against a candidate, particularly when so many women actually do get their faces bashed in every day, often in their own homes by men who supposedly love them. This incident was so disappointing. I've seen and heard a lot of misogynistic stuff this campaign season, but I didn't expect it on a show with such a seemingly strong female host. And listener Elaine Kress in Athens, Georgia, seconds that emotion. Elaine says, I don't think the commentary that expresses the use of violence is in any way appropriate.
Elaine and Karen, I do completely appreciate your feedback. I did respond to Kevin, but not in a way that either of you connected with. I also knew that some people would think his metaphor crossed the line into bad taste. And to be honest, one reason we have the Bloggers Roundtable is because you get to hear voices and tones and opinions, because they're just that, opinions, that you don't hear on NPR otherwise. We've had some pretty rough and ready roundtables, and I'm sure we're going to have more in the future. So thank you for giving your feedback on this. Also, listener Robert Hill tuned in for our story about ancient Egypt's black pharaohs. NPR's Tony Cox spoke with the author about a piece about the Nubian kings featured on the cover of last month's National Geographic magazine. Robert Hill writes, "Thank you, News and Notes, for doing the interview with Robert Draper. I've been studying Kush and Egypt for many, many years now. I was thrilled to hear a story about Africa's other great civilization, Kush. And I was glad to hear the interview presented during Black History Month. I'm overjoyed to see the month expanded into Africa. As African Americans, we need to claim that history as well.
And finally, Jordy Thompson sent us a little love from the Northwest. Jordy says, I'm a 33-year-old white guy in Portland, Oregon. We don't get your show on the radio here, but I listen to the podcast religiously. I'm deeply grateful for the insight it provides. Oregon isn't exactly a hotbed of racial diversity, and African-American voices are not prevalent in our public discourse, much to our loss. Your coverage offers a refreshing and nuanced look at current events that are generally bleached in the media. Thanks for broadening my view of our society.
Thanks, Jordy, and thank you all for writing in.
And that's it for letters, but please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. Be sure to choose News and Notes when you send in your electronic response. And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. Christopher, thanks.
You got it, Farai.